Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 67. My name is Karen, and I am joined by both Kristen and Callie.
Speak, Callie, speak! I was hoping she would meow at that exact moment.
Did you see how she gulped?
Are you nervous? Do you have stage fright? It's okay.
She just really wants to be in here with us, so...
We're gonna try it.
Yeah. I will not be held responsible for the amount of noise she makes.
Or the amount of times we're distracted. Huh? Yes. What? Karen, yeah. You said something to me? Oh, I was staring at the adorable kitten.
Yeah.
Fine, ignore me. See how much I care. Anyway.
Yeah, so, hi, hello. We're gonna be talking about The Sun and the Stars today.
Woohoo!
It's very exciting.
Chapter one.
Yeah, it's very cool. This is a long time coming, and still a long time coming, but
yes.
It'll be great. If you would like... Yeah. If you would like to contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com, you can do that. I don't know why I started that sentence with if you...
The beginning of that sentence felt strange, and I was like, she's going to wrap it up. It's going to be fine. Don't panic. Don't worry. And you did, so it's all that matters.
You should have panicked. You should have worried.
Meh, meh.
We are jumping into our news because somehow there is still news after everything we went through last week.
There was so much news last week.
Yeah, and I was so proud of how much I cut from that episode, but that episode was massive because there was just so much news to catch up on.
It's true.
Yeah, and we actually do have some big stuff to talk about today, which I'm actually excited about, but first, more birthdays. Yeah. Magnus Chase was born on January 13th, Friday the 13th, according to Becky, so
ooh,
that's kind of exciting. And then Daniel Jose Older was born on January 18th, which is also very exciting.
Happy birthday!
Yeah! And speaking of, this is a great segue, right after we recorded, of course they revealed another cover for one of the Rick Riordan Presents books, but... This one was worth the wait. Last Canto of the Dead by Daniel Jose Older. This is a sequel to Ballad and Dagger. This cover...
Yeah.
...is, honestly, like... I mean, obviously it's like a fantasy book because there's like lightning and stuff like that. But the way that he's holding her is like a romance novel. And I am into it.
It's a little bit romancy. It's a, also... I find it interesting, the way he's got his arm around her, but she's still just like, okay, dude, I'm trying to fight here.
Yeah, I mean, she's still, like very much herself.
Excuse you, I've got fighting to do. So, it's, honestly, I love it. It's great. Plus, it's, like, purple, so...
Yeah, that's true. It looks fantastic.
It
I'm
really
so
is.
Excited for this. So, we have the official synopsis as well. And it reads, two gods-turned-teenagers wage simultaneous battles in the Caribbean and Brooklyn in this breathless sequel to Ballad and Dagger. Mateo Matisse and Chela Hidalgo are not just two teenagers in love. They're powerful gods in human form, powerful enough to have saved their Brooklyn diaspora community from the wrath of an ancient enemy and to have raised their once-sunken native island of San Madrigal from the sea. But soon, they discover that their problems are far from over. On the shores of San Madrigal, two creature armies are battling for survival, and on the streets of Brooklyn, a once-tight-knit community is divided, with two sides at each other's throats. But worst of all, a heartbreaking prophecy rips these two young lovers apart, sending Mateo back to the city, where cops are now patrolling the streets, and keeping Chela tethered to the island, where chaos and death lurk around every corner. Healer, destroyer, creator, as gods, their powers know no limits, but as teenagers, separated, desperate, grieving, what will become of them, and what will become of their people? Dang.
I mean, yeah.
That is, I hadn't read that synopsis before, to be perfectly honest.
That
is a good synopsis.
Callie agrees. Yeah, no, that's intense. And there's a lot in there, like a lot of detail about what's going on in this book. And I'm sure it's probably just the beginning.
I know.
And that's nuts.
It really is, because like we know they get separated, but then what happens from there, we have no idea.
Right.
So,
yeah. So, yeah, it's... And it's all prophecy-based.
That's true. It's a perfect fit.
I mean, it slips right in there, right into our sweet spot.
Yeah. And this is coming out not too long after The Son and the Star. This comes out on May 16th. So we got a couple of months to wait, but this one's definitely going to be a good one. If you have not read Battle and Dagger yet, you should. And
yes.
Sorry you had to listen to that synopsis, but it's really, really good. You guys should listen to it.
Highly recommend.
Yeah. Reed Riordan put out a couple other articles this past week as well. The first one is The Tourist's Guide to Tartarus, which I found very funny because their tips are pack only the essentials, leave behind the extra baggage, and they're not just talking about physical items. Take your time sightseeing, don't harass the locals. Most important, don't complain about your accommodations. And it's actually a pretty funny article, and obviously it's kind of a lead up to The Son and the Star and the fact that they're going to Tartarus. And Reed Riordan also posted about the Rick Riordan Presents books that are coming out in 2023, which of course we did a couple of weeks ago. So listen to our podcast episode.
You'll get all the answers, but if you need it in print.
Yeah, that's true. If you need it in print, then they've got you covered. And it's pretty much everything that we talked about. There's nothing surprising on the list. But what I found most interesting was that Pahua and the Dragon's Secret by Laurie M. Lee and Moco Magic by Tracy Baptiste are both not featured, despite previous notes that they'd be coming in 2023. So maybe they're not going to be until November, December. Although I'm not sure if we've gotten Rick Riordan Presents books as late as November and December. Because usually, I think Yoon-Ha Lee's first book possibly came out in January. Mm-hmm. And I think that might have been the earliest that we've gotten it. So they might take those 2 months off.
Yeah.
But it's possible that they might have gotten moved to 2024.
Also, yeah, definitely possible.
Which, considering there's 10 books on this list, I'm okay with them pushing a couple to next year.
Yeah, I agree too.
Yeah. But it's all good. Very excited. And just a reminder that Winston Chu is the one that's coming up next. And we will have something about that. More on that soon.
Yep.
So I also wanted to talk about J.C. Cervantes, who wrote the Stormrunner series and is currently writing the spinoff Lords of Night series. She has an adult debut coming out called The Enchanted Hacienda, and I just wanted to read, like, the publisher's weekly thing here. Basically, it's part of a 6-figure 2-book agreement, which, like, you go, girl.
I know, right? Wow.
That's awesome. And it says that it's inspired by Mexican folklore as a grown-up version of Encanto. It follows a young woman named Harlow Estrada, whose female relatives have the power to grow and use the magical flowers on the family farm. Harlow, however, seems to have no magical gifts until she finally opens her heart to a stranger and pursues her dream of becoming a writer.
That sounds pretty.
This
very, very pretty, and
it sounds like something we would both really enjoy.
Yeah, probably.
I mean, grown-up version of Encanto, yes, please.
I mean, I may or may not have listened to Encanto's soundtrack on my way over.
Really?
I have a Disney playlist that's been going lately, and it's been making me happy. So, yeah. The Family Madrigal is definitely stuck in my head running, you know, as we speak.
But this sounds really good, and I'm really excited that this is her adult debut, just like Roshni is having her adult debut out soon. And I really like when, you know, authors kind of throw everything at the wall and just see what sticks and write in different genres and categories.
I was going to say, writing for different audiences is stretching a totally different muscle almost. Yeah. Like, I mean, when you're writing for middle grade, the audience, there's specific things that you can and can't do in those kinds of books that, you know, maybe you have a story you want to tell, but it kind of requires you to go to a darker place or to something a little more adult that just lends itself to being more of an adult book. Yeah. And I think that lets her readers kind of grow with her, too.
Because
definitely. That way, like, you know, if you read the middle grade, if you loved Stormrunner a couple years ago, and now you're in college or past college, maybe, you know, you're looking for maybe an adult novel, knowing that J.C. has one for you, it's like, hey, that's awesome. Like, I already know I like her books. So yeah. This will be a nice change. Do something a little different.
I'm definitely looking forward to this. I think it's going to be really cool. I don't know that they announced when it's coming out, but I think it's going to be 2024.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, considering how long it takes for some of these things to be put together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Paula Santiago is also getting translated into Spanish, which is a very big deal for Taylor. As a mixed kid growing up without Spanish fluency, I always felt I was missing out on some important piece of my identity puzzle. That's part of the reason Pau struggles to reconnect with the language throughout the books. It's been a long-held dream of mine to see one of my books in Spanish. And she wrote this on Instagram. But I just, considering the character and knowing where Paula's struggle with Spanish comes from, I was really excited to see this news and I really wanted to include it. So
yeah, that's cool.
Congratulations to Taylor, who also has a book coming out soonish that hopefully I will be reviewing on Subjectify. So many books. I can't, like, I have next month, February.
It's the shortest month of the year and Karen has overextended herself way beyond any previous attempt.
Yeah. So if you like books, especially dark, spooky kind of books, keep an eye on Subjectify. I will be covering a lot of them.
Why is February a spooky month?
I feel like January
and February have become like scary movie, scary book release time. Like,
that's true. A lot of movies come out in
January.
You always
get them in October, like, obviously. Yeah. But I feel like January and February have become another spooky time of year where you can get a lot of really good darker, like gothic kind of novels.
Yeah. I think there's something in Valentine's Day that can be very easily flipped to like a tragic love story, a gothic tale. So February makes a lot of sense to me. Rick also answered some more questions on Goodreads. He's been doing this like every couple of weeks now and I really like it. Some of the questions are pretty basic. Some might not be super related. I just gathered two of them that I thought were particularly relevant to his future projects, including The Sun and the Star. So one question asked, will we ever get the story of Nico's 3 days in the infirmary with Will after the war and how they first got together? And Rick says, you will get quite a lot of Nico and Will's backstory in The Sun and the Star, which
that's good.
Doesn't tell us anything, but tells us what to expect, so I'm cool with that.
We may not get the entire 3 days in chapter form, but it sounds like we'll hear about how they kind of met and really got to know each other well and how they kicked things off.
So. Yeah. And then somebody else asked him if he ever runs out of ideas, and he said, weirdly, ideas are the easy part. I never run out of ideas. I have half a dozen right now that I may or may not get to use for books because of time and bandwidth. The hard part is actually writing them down and turning them into books. That never gets easier, alas. Which is not the kind of writing advice I want to hear, Rick. Like, that is not an inspiration for
me. It's supposed to get easier,
yeah.
Rick.
But this just kind of encouraged me in terms of, like, he always has ideas. He always is looking for that next idea that can be turned into a book. One of the things that I was actually thinking about earlier in regards to him, I can't remember if it's something else that I put on here or I was just having, like, a stray thought. But, like, his legacy and I think it had to do with the chapter.
Mm-hmm.
His legacy and this world and how expansive it is. Like, there's so many stories that you could tell in the Percy Jackson universe, let alone any other ideas that he has in his head. So just, you know, knowing that we could possibly continue to get stuff from him for as long as he wants to write is really exciting as a big fan.
Right, yeah. I'm glad that ideas are easy for him and that he's constantly just kind of coming up with things and keeping, you know, I'm sure he's got an idea notebook or an idea notes app where he's keeping track, like, oh yeah, I could write that, like, could be a book, or this could be a story, I could do that. Like, I like that he's got, some stuff kind of on the back burner, because, it just means that he's still actively looking for things to write about. Like, it makes me happy to know that there's no shortage of inspiration for him. It's just a matter of What do I have time for? What can I do? What can I feasibly accomplish in this year that I am also producing a television show and on set for all of that? Like, how much can I write and produce and, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It makes me very happy to know that he's not, like, running out of ideas.
And yeah.
Isn't dipping back into the Percy well because he is run out of any other ideas. Like, I love to know that he's got all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's what I liked about the Chalice of the Gods announcement, is it felt very genuine. It felt like a desire to return to this world versus like, oh, I just, you know, he doesn't need more money. But, you know, somebody who just wants to keep putting it out because he knows it'll sell. Like, it came from a place where it felt very genuine to me.
I was going
to
say, I'm not going to lie, and this might be controversial, but that whole new book from Suzanne Collins in the Hunger Games saga, like, I feel like that is such a complete story that I am not sure I'm ever going to read the Ballad of Snakes and Songs of Snakes.
A copy of it and I have not cracked it open.
Yeah, like, I don't know if I ever really want to read it. I feel like that story is contained and done and over, and I don't know if I want to know more about President Snow. So, like, that almost to me felt a little bit like a, well, I would like to tap back into this well.
Yeah.
Like, it would be one thing if there was another character whose story she wanted to tell in the universe or later on after the revolution or whatever, but like going back and doing a prequel book after the fact just feels like that for me.
Yeah.
Whereas with Rick, he's filling in gaps, he's answering questions that, you know, readers have always had, he's telling stories that answer more questions than, you know, they always make more questions too. But, you know, he's always like, yeah, you know, I can fill in this gap of time that I left in between these books with this story, and it answers some other questions and does some other things for the entire universe. So.
Yeah. And I also appreciate the fact that he was very upfront about writing this book in support of the television show.
Right, absolutely.
Like, he wasn't trying to hide that, and I can give him props for
that. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was Seaweed Brain Podcast tweeted the other day about needing an assistant just to help them keep up with all of Rick's forthcoming projects, and like, I felt that really, really badly, because it's getting hard to keep track of everything, especially when you throw in Rick Riordan Presents stuff. Like,
it gets very,
I'm
very
glad we have a list of it now.
Right, yeah.
But speaking of Rick's projects, Maze of Bones, which I actually never read. I would like to get into that at some point. It's the 39 Clues series, and I'm pretty sure this is the one where, like, he co-wrote it with somebody, and then each book is written by, like, a different author, a different set of authors. And the first book in that series is becoming a graphic novel, which will be out on April 4th, so if you are more inclined toward graphic novels, pick that up. It's a best-selling series, as I'm not surprised, but maybe you'll like it. Let us know what you think. So he's been posting on Mastodon quite a bit and just kind of not really giving us news, but like little mini updates in conjunction with learning the Irish language. And Rick recently had a Zoom call with his Dublin-based production partners for the My Life as a Child Outlaw TV adaptation, which was the Finn McCool short story he wrote. And that is kind of exciting that he's meeting with production partners and stuff like that, and that they're Dublin-based, which means that hopefully the cast and crew will be from Ireland, that it'll be a very authentic kind of production, like they did with Harry Potter, having, you know, a British cast, British crew, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
He also got to see Grover with his goat hooves on for the first time the other day, which I was, like, weirdly excited about.
I mean, If that's the first time that Rick has seen them, I'm sure it was a sight.
Yeah.
Like, you get Ariane, I'm sure, with the horns and with the hair and with the hoodie for all the close-ups and stuff, but seeing him, like, with the hooves on has to be a sight.
And he also witnessed Poseidon saying an iconic line the other day, which, I mean, I feel like that could be so many things, because we're at the end of production, so, like, are they doing, like, a flashback kind of thing, or are they doing something that's right at the end of that, like, when they're
after the Ares battle?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. He also hinted that we're possibly getting some news next week, which is, since this episode comes out on Monday, will be this week. So maybe we'll have something major to discuss, Poseidon and Zeus.
For next week. Yeah, that would be fantastic, Rick.
Yeah.
Even all of his little clues and dangling.
I know.
The thing about Poseidon saying an iconic line was almost cruel.
It was.
It was like, oh, by the way, I heard Poseidon. So it's like, oh, yeah. So, you know, we all knew they had already been cast. But it's like, oh, so there's actual proof that this character has been cast and you just are holding it back because you're a cruel and unusual.
And it was so funny because I found this very curious, too, because somebody asked Becky if Poseidon has a beard. And Becky said she didn't know because she hadn't looked at dailies yet, which tells me that maybe Poseidon hasn't been on set for very long, that maybe he only came in here at the end to do all of his scenes.
I can imagine that's a possibility.
Yeah. I wonder if the TV show will kind of, like, hold back on the gods a little bit, especially Zeus and Poseidon, just to, like, make us want to see them more.
Well, the other thing is, if they had an idea for somebody that they wanted to play Poseidon or Zeus or both, and scheduling worked out better, if they waited until December or January to kind of come on board, then maybe they specifically postponed certain scenes, certain, you know, things, and said, hey, you know, we're going to get these at the end because we want this actor and we're kind of waiting for their schedule to clear up, and we know if we wait till January we can, you know.
Yeah.
So hopefully it means that, like, they had a specific vision and wanted someone specific, and that's why we don't know who they are yet, is because they were kind of waiting for them to get on board, to get their scenes done, and then they can kind of make the announcement.
Yeah,
so
that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I'm just hoping this means that they have a specific, like, it didn't, I don't want to know that, like, it was hard casting Poseidon or Zeus.
Yeah.
Like, I want it to be like, oh, we had somebody in mind, and it was just a matter of organizing schedules, but we made it happen, and it's perfect, and yeah. Like,
yeah,
that's what I want. I'll be okay any way it is. But that's what my heart wants, is for it to just be so, like, kismet and perfect, and it's the right person, and yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So that's it for our news this week. We're going to jump right into our discussion. We are talking about The Sun and the Star, Chapter 1. This was found in the back of the Sword of Hades short story that was re-released with a new cover on January 10th. And unfortunately, if you are an international listener, you probably weren't able to pick this up, as we found out from some of our other listeners, which is a super, super bummer. So obviously, if you want to skip this episode, like, we'll totally understand if you want to read it for yourself first, or maybe because you couldn't get your hands on it, you're happy to have us discuss it, which I'm happy to do. So yeah, I'm actually going to ask you your opinions at the end of this discussion so that we can kind of, like, go through it and then give our overall feel for it. So I want to start off first with kind of this opening chapter, which was, like, you know, a pretty normal length chapter in the book. And we have Austin Lake and Kayla Knowles, along with Nico and Will. And Austin and Kayla are both children of Apollo. Austin has a proficiency for music and Kayla for archery. And they've been in the books before, especially Trials of Apollo, they featured a little more heavily. So it was kind of cool just to, like, bring them back. And they are debating who they would go on a date with in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah.
This feels like such a Mark thing to put in there. And just, like, the way that they talk about it, like, you can tell it's coming from a place of fandom. You can tell that this is, like, what kids talk about.
Well, and I love that clearly Mark made Will a massive, like, Star Wars fan.
Yes.
Like, Will is the one who knows Star Wars in and out. Nico is just kind of being exposed to it because his boyfriend likes it so much. So it's like, it's really cute kind of seeing that happen. It's adorable.
I really felt this because I did not grow up on Star Wars. I only watched it, I mean, I keep saying a few years ago. At this point, it's probably been like a decade I watched it. But, you know, it's a very recent thing for me. And so I was like, when he joked about not knowing anybody else's names and, like, are those made up characters? Felt that in my soul. There are so many character names in Star Wars.
And they all sound vaguely the same. So it's kind of hard sometimes to, like, what's the difference between, you know, Ben Kenobi and Obi-Wan? And it can get kind of confusing. So I understand that people, yeah. I was not a massive fan. I am not a massive Star Wars fan. I appreciate it. My brother was a huge fan growing up, so I watched them as a kid. I saw them when I was younger. But it's not a fandom that I'm, like, bullish about, but I still enjoy it. I still like the movies, and I love Rey, and, you know.
I mean, Force Awakens is my favorite Star Wars movie.
I honestly think that is mine. The older ones are fine, but I was not as excited about them as I was The Force Awakens.
Yeah. I have a lot to say on that subject, but I feel like this is not the place to do it.
Right, we can't keep going.
Yeah.
But we can talk about Nico's choice.
We can, because his choice was Darth Vader.
Nico.
And who was it? Was it Austin or Kayla? Was like, Kylo Ren is right there. And I was like, I agree.
I think it was Kayla.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nico. Oh, Nico.
But Will, like, making it make sense, like, oh, he's very decisive, like, you know, and I was like, you know, you are making a play for Darth Vader now, like, an argument for him. I totally get that.
Oh, yeah. I would have thought someone a little newer, like, Kylo Ren, or if he wasn't so worried about, like, the darkness of it, like, it doesn't surprise me that Nico went for a dark character.
Right,
like,
yeah.
That's not surprising.
Yeah.
But Kylo Ren is, like, drastically prettier.
I was gonna say, he's objectively a handsome man.
Or even, like, say Darth Vader, but say, like, Hayden Christensen Darth Vader.
Right, like,
because,
young.
Like, yeah, like, yeah. He becomes Darth Vader, spoiler alert. you know, his character Anakin becomes Darth Vader.
Right, he said Darth Vader, not Anakin.
Right, and so I'm like, why wouldn't you just say Anakin? Because he's so much cuter before all the maiming and the suit and the breathing and the... So, I do understand Nico and the darkness factor, but, like, I was like, why wouldn't you go with the pretty man, not the, you know, other one? Anyway.
Yeah.
It is an interesting choice.
It is.
But that way.
But you know what? It's not that it doesn't make sense, because it kind of does.
It does. And I with you, also agree. I love that Will makes it make sense. Like,
yeah.
he convinces us that Nico's not crazy.
Yeah. So, as funny as this scene was, I actually felt like this was a very significant moment because I feel like it foreshadows Nico having trouble with making decisions, as well as his worry that Will might stop liking him, because he's like, I don't know, I can't say who I would want to go on a date with, because what if I make the wrong decision? And then he thinks to himself, like, you know, what if I make a decision, Will doesn't like me anymore, and he kind of has to, like, talk himself out of it. And this just felt so significant to me. Like, this is definitely setting up a hard choice later on and a point where Will and Nico are probably going to have to, like, have a discussion about something.
Yeah.
So, I'm worried.
I also wonder if Nico kind of was thinking, like, if I pick a darker character, is Will going to think that that means that I don't, you know, like, he is light incarnate.
Yeah.
Like, Will is the lightest, happiest, you know, sunniest character in the world, I swear. And so, like, I can see Nico saying, like, oh, well, if I said I would go on a date with a darker character, is Will gonna think that I'm saying something about him? Like, I can, you know, he's young, he's a teenager.
Yeah.
Those are things that are gonna go through your head. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think this definitely is foreshadowing, like, some complications that are definitely going to come to fruition throughout the book.
Yeah, for sure. And we also learn that they've been together for a year, which it feels like it's been so much longer.
It's because for us it's been like 5.
Yeah, or more. Yeah, it's been a long time. But this is pretty cool. A year is not an insignificant amount of time, and there is a lot of chemistry between them. The grumpy little ball of darkness and sunshine incarnate. I feel like Mark, and I mean Rick too, obviously, but this to me feels a little bit more like Mark, even though I haven't read him before. And maybe I'm just, you know, making all this up. But the chemistry that they have together, it kind of feels a little bit like a romance novel. Like, there's just so much there between them.
I'm a sucker for a grumpy sunshine.
Yeah.
Like, romance. Like, that's one of... I love a grumpy hero. Grumpy heroines are great, too. But I love a grumpy hero.
Yeah.
So, honestly, it's He mentioned that we were going to get some of this grumpy sunshine thing way back when. I feel like this was back in, like, September when we were first talking about what we were going to get in Son of the Star. And, like, you get it right off the bat. First chapter, you get this little interplay between them, and you really do get a sense of their chemistry and how they work. Because it's one thing to say, like, oh, opposites attract. I'm going to write a book with a dark character and a light character, and they really, you know, they totally work. But it's another to actually write the chemistry mm-hmm. and to really make it feel authentic and like they work. And right off the bat. It works.
Yeah, for sure.
I also have to say, I also loved the significant annoyance rather than significant other. Like, I was like, oh my god, they're so cute. Like,
I know.
Just be wittier, I dare you.
I couldn't remember if that was a callback to something else.
I couldn't either. I was like, it might be a callback to something, like, to a moment from one of the previous books. But I still loved it.
Yeah. It made me really happy. And there's just so many moments where you do get to see how they are opposites, but they still work. Like, I think Nico references, like, never being happy, and Will grimaces, but then he makes Nico laugh, and it's just, like, it still works even though they are very different people.
Yeah.
But the setting, it also plays a part in this chapter. Summer is over. Everyone is leaving Camp Half-Blood, but Nico and Will are staying behind. They're actually the only ones staying behind, except for some staff and some satyrs and dryads. So Kayla and Austin are the last two campers, besides them, to leave Camp Half-Blood. And they have to take the Gray Sisters' taxi, which we've seen before in the books. And again, they hammer home this fear of making the wrong decision. So, like, it's neon lights worth of foreshadowing.
Oh, yeah. we got a really strong, like, Kayla and Austin had to make a choice about how they were getting home, and they aren't sure they made the right decision, but the decision is made, and this, like, they really, like, hammer home that this decision-making thing is going to be a recurring theme.
Yeah.
Not just with Nico. I mean, even here with Kayla and Austin.
Right.
This decision is something that's freaking them both out. So,
yeah.
Definitely gonna come back.
And I love how Nico loves the Gray Sisters because they're, like, dark and weird. He's like, yeah, they're super strange and, like, you never really know what you're going to get from them, but I really like them. And I was like, I understand that.
I was half expecting them to, like, look at Nico and just kind of, like, smile and then go back to being super weird or something, because I doubt there's any other demigods that really find them even appealing at all. So, like, just having any demigod kind of appreciate them, I'm sure, would, like, be nice.
Yeah.
I would love to. I'm curious if we'll get more of them in the book.
That's what I was wondering, too, because it felt like, you know, it reintroduced who the Gray Sisters are. It reminds us how everything operates, their names, the fact that they share one eyeball, like, the whole taxi service and everything. And it felt like, okay, remember who these people are? We're probably going to see them again later in the book. So how do you think something like that could end up playing out? Because the other part of that is that Nico was going to shadow travel them to their respective homes for a year. And then they were like, no, you're not, you know, a shadow travel service. So I'm thinking maybe if he can't shadow travel, they use the taxis again?
Possibly. Because I think it's Will who says, Nico, you know that really wears you out. You can't be running. And, like, one of them was going to New York, so it wouldn't have been too bad. But the other was going all the way to Ontario. So, like, it would have been a longer trip. So, yeah, I think it was Will who says to Nico, like, you know you can't do that all the time. And, you know, it's going to wear you out, that sort of thing. I mean, Rick has definitely made these callback things before. Yeah, we just had this moment in the last chapter of The Last Olympian where we had the Fates cutting Luke's string. And, like, that was a full circle moment from the beginning of Lightning Thief all the way to Last Olympian. So, like, I definitely could see this you know, we don't hear from the Gray Sisters again for most of the book, and then by the end something happens and we have to return to their taxi for whatever reason. I definitely think this could be a bit of a,
like, a Chekhov's gun kind of thing.
Yeah, like, we're throwing this in at the beginning, it's going to be significant later.
Foreshadowing kind of too. Yeah, I agree. I think it would make sense for them to come back at some point during the book. And I think the reason why they come back is going to be more interesting. You know, why can't Nico shadow travel if that's the case or whatever? And where is he going?
Well, and maybe his appreciation of them will work into that. Maybe they'll appreciate that someone finally sees them as something other than just those weirdos who drive a creepy taxi and have one eye. Like, maybe they'll be more willing to help him with something or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So after Kayla and Austin leave, Nico is kind of thinking through everything and he ponders the voice that he's been hearing and the prophecy that Rachel recited. He's very clear to say that this is not an end-of-the-world scenario, that it merely concerns somebody asking him for help.
I have to say, we have had so much, end of the world, the world is ending, the world is ending, we have to save the world, that I am immediately appreciative that this story is not about them saving the world.
Yeah. Kind of like Chalice of the Gods, where we know it's not going to be about saving the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like that this is a Nico and Will story. It's not suddenly going to gain 13 other people who are traveling with them, and they're fighting, evil, and it becomes more, like, I want this to be their story, and whatever happens to them on this little trip they're going to be taking. Like, I'm actually really happy that it's not this massive scale problem. It's them figuring out this voice and what's going on and going from there.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there, because when it becomes the apocalypse, then you do have to bring in other people, because it's very hard to save the world by yourself. And that makes sense, and that's fine, and there are definitely places for those kinds of stories. But making this something that only concerns Nico and Will allow you to hold a magnifying glass to them as characters and their relationship, and it can be a lot more personal and a lot more intimate of a story. So
definitely.
I'm really looking forward to that as well. And Nico says that he hasn't told anyone except Will about the voice. He hasn't told Chiron, he hasn't told any of the other campers. Nobody knows except for Will. And this next part actually hit me really hard, because he talks about, like, feeling happy. Like, there's that moment where Will is kind of chasing him back to camp and everything, and, like, he feels happy for a few minutes. And then he remembers the voice calling out to him from Tartarus, and he feels guilty about his own happiness. And I just have to say, like, this is what the voice of depression sounds like in your head. When you're happy, you remember or you feel like you should be sad. And I'm really interested to see if this is going to be a thread that plays throughout the book, where I think it will be, because Will is such a different character from him, and he tends to be a very happy, bright individual. How Nico struggles not only with allowing himself happiness, but realizing that, like, Will is his boyfriend and that he loves him no matter what. It could end up getting very heavy, but, like, in a good way.
I'm also interested to see if Will can help take the world off of Nico's shoulders. I feel like Nico feels that everybody's problem is his problem, and unless everyone in the world and under it are content or happy, if there's something else wrong somewhere, he feels like he has to fix it before he can allow himself to be happy. Mm-hmm. Like here, the world has been saved. Everything is okay. This is after Tower of Nero, so Nero, that whole thing is done. I love where he mentions in the chapter, if I never hear his voice in his name again, it'll be too soon. Like, we get that. Like, the world has been saved. So you think he could take a moment and say, like, okay, I'm allowed to have a minute. I'm allowed to be happy. I'm allowed to enjoy some time with my boyfriend before I start figuring out what this other voice is I can hear and all of that. You know, and it might be depression. It might be some of that mental health-related things that need to be talked about in this book, which I'm sure we will get some of that.
Yeah.
But I also just feel like there's a good chance here that Will can help Nico see that not every problem is his problem, and sometimes you have to pass the buck. Sometimes you have to say, I am not the one to solve every problem that's caused by the gods.
Mm-hmm.
You're a demigod. You're not a god. The gods could solve a lot of problems if they wanted, and they don't. So it's not on you to fix everything always.
Yeah.
And if that ends up being a bit of this book, that's going to be something that kind of is very personal for me too, because I have a tendency to take on more than I can handle. Like, I feel like if somebody is upset, it's my responsibility to fix it before any of my stuff. Like, Kristen, why are you worried about that? And so I kind of feel for Nico in that way, yeah. And I would really love to see Will kind of help him see that, like, not everything is your problem.
Yeah. Nico's a very relatable character just because of everything he's been through and the way that he, you know, he is kind of a closed off character, but at the same time, I feel like he wears his heart on his sleeve too. Like, you kind of know how he's feeling. And I find that to be very interesting. And on the flip side of that, I'm very curious how Will be throughout this book, because as we've learned, we're going to get more of him than we ever have before. He's getting his own POV chapters. Sunshine people also struggle with depression. Mm-hmm. They also get sad. And I'm very curious if he will just be there to kind of prop up Nico, or if maybe the opposite will have to occur. And then, you know how you, like, convince your friends, like, you wouldn't talk to me like that, so why are you talking to yourself like that? I kind of wonder if, like, that's going to be a moment in this book where Nico and Will kind of understand each other on an even deeper level.
Yeah. No, I'm expecting to get layers of Will that we have never seen before.
Right.
And I do think some of it will have some darkness or
yeah.
some personal problems or things that Will struggles with, because while he is, you know, demigod of Apollo, all about light and all of that, like, it doesn't mean that there's not things that make his life hard.
Yeah.
And I want to know what makes Will's life hard and how does Nico help with that. And, you know, I want to see them really, like, balance each other
yeah.
and work toward that.
For sure. And I think in that same vein, we learn in this chapter that Will really does not want to talk about the underworld. He wants to appreciate the break that they have now that the world has been saved, but he also seems afraid. And as the son of Apollo, I can understand that, like, not wanting to go to the underworld. It's difficult enough for literally everyone except for children of Hades and Hermes, the god Hermes. But since Will is the son of Apollo, who is the sun god and all of that, like, him going in the underworld is going to probably be even tougher than the average demigod.
Agreed, yeah.
So, Nico, you know, he wants to talk about the underworld, but he kind of understands that Will doesn't want to, and he also mentions that there are other things he doesn't want to remember. Quote, ghosts that would probably visit him eventually. And that was very interesting to me. Because
yeah.
I was like, my first thought was Minos, because Minos is still kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Nico have come up against each other before. We saw that in Battle of the Labyrinth. I'm pretty sure that was that whole plot line.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
And they, you know, that ending, it did not end well for King Minos. Let's
no.
just say that. And so I'm like, okay, is he afraid to go to the underworld because of who he might encounter? Or is this kind of an allusion to, there are ghosts out there who have a bone to pick with Nico that he just hasn't gotten a chance to talk to yet? But you had an idea as well.
Yeah, I mean, you had mentioned in our notes here that there's an obvious one that
yeah.
kind of jumps out at you, because we know this is a character who died in Tower of Nero, or did he die
no.
in the book before that?
Book three.
Oh, yeah, okay,
yeah.
yeah. We all know that. Spoiler for anyone. I'm just throwing it out there. Here's your chance. Jason Grace died.
Yeah.
And, like, that kind of is an obvious one. Like, oh, he doesn't want to see Jason. He doesn't want to deal with Jason. Like, I get that, you know. I also kind of wondered if maybe he's avoiding going to the underworld because maybe he thinks Bianca is kind of waiting for him. Maybe she doesn't like that he's not putting enough time into, like, the Will side of things. He's worrying too much about things that he can't control.
Right.
He's doing all this other stuff. Like, I could see Bianca kind of nudging him when he's in the underworld, like, hey, why are you not taking advantage of the happiness, like, sitting at your doorstep? Maybe she's, you know, a little bit of a nagging older sister. They do that. You know, like, I could see that being a reason why he kind of avoids the underworld, or why he, you know, is kind of unsure if he wants to go back. It also occurred to me just now, and I know that, like, Octavian was technically Roman camp,
mm-hmm.
but, like, maybe he's avoiding some of those characters, too, like, the not good characters, not friends, but some of them that died in the Trials of Apollo storyline, like, he doesn't want to deal with other demigods that died that may have a bone to pick with him because of his role in all of that, you know, stuff like that.
That's kind of how I'm feeling, because when he says, like, other things he didn't want to remember, that was something that felt very ominous and dark to me. So, like, Bianca coming to see him, I mean, that would still hurt him because it's his sister, but I feel like, for the most part, he has come to terms with what happened to her. Mm-hmm. You know, he's forgiven Percy and all of that. And now that I keep thinking about it, I really feel like it is going to be Jason, because he doesn't want to remember that Jason died. He hasn't... has he talked to... I don't think he's talked to Jason yet.
I don't think so.
So...
I was trying to remember that, too.
Yeah. So if he hasn't talked to Jason yet, I would bet money that this is about Jason. If he has talked to him, then I'm very curious as to who this could be about, that maybe it's somewhere in the canon, something that is kind of a loose thread that's going to be...
I may or may not have gone through the Riordan Wiki death list.
Oh, there's a
death list.
There's a
dead characters list.
Yeah.
And it includes monsters, all the bad characters, all of that too.
Yeah.
And I kind of just did a quick scroll through to kind of remind myself some of these main, you know, major characters that have died, that maybe they would be somebody that he's avoiding that could come back. The only character that kind of maybe made me think was Hazel's mother.
Okay.
Not for any specific reason, but, like, maybe she plagues Nico because she has something she wants to tell Hazel, or I feel like there's a possibility for a little bit of a callback with Hazel's mom.
Yeah.
But other than that, there's not really a ton of characters that died that their stories don't feel complete. Like, you could say Beckendorf. You could say, you know, Selena. But I feel like we kind of got their endings. And I don't think Rick's going to want to pull back on those threads.
Yeah.
He could. Definitely. I would love to see Beckendorf again. But I just don't think he's going to go pulling those threads for Nico and Will's story. So that was the Hazel Levesque's mom story. The only reason why is because of Hazel's close relationship to Nico and, like, that. That was the only reason I thought maybe she could come into play. But other than that, I think it's Jason.
Yeah.
It just feels like Jason's the most unfulfilled story. Like, there's something sitting out there waiting to be resolved for him.
Yeah, it's one of the most... It is the most recent major death. Even if they went back to talk about Beckendorf, like, that was a long time ago. Like, that, as far as I know, as far as I can tell, doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in the present.
Agreed.
You know? Like,
yeah.
Kronos has been taken care of. That's kind of the end of that.
Yeah.
So, we'll just have to see, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But one of the major things that jumped out to me in this chapter was we did not get to hear the prophecy, and I was kind of bummed. I really wanted the prophecy in the opening chapter, but we have to wait for it. And, you know, this is obviously sitting heavy on Will's shoulders as well as Nico, so I'm very curious as to, like, what the actual details are with regard to the prophecy. But the chapter ends with, it would be fine. Everything would be fine. Which is, like,
it's a little, just, if I say it.
The dog in the fire.
Yeah. If I say it, it makes it true, right?
Yeah.
So this is Nico saying, everything's fine. It's gonna be fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah. I don't believe it. And considering this is the first chapter in a book where we know a lot of stuff is gonna happen, it definitely feels ominous.
Yeah.
But it is fine for now until we get the second chapter or the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just want to say that this chapter was pretty much just a setup, which we knew. It's chapter one. There wasn't going to be a whole lot going on, but it was still very good. You still get some great character moments. You get some funny dialogue. You get a little bit of setup as to, like, everybody's leaving camp and the whole, like, underworld prophecy Tartarus thing is looming over them. I really enjoyed it, like, immediately getting thrown back into this world.
It's been a while since we were in this world with a new story.
Yeah.
Like, we've reread things, obviously. We've reread stories we know, and we've been surprised by some elements of those books that we had forgotten. But there's just something different about starting a new adventure in this universe, and yeah, it was a good chapter. It got me excited for the book. It reminded me of, you know, what I love about Nico and the things that are going to be really interesting to delve deep into with his character and with Will. And yeah, it's a good chapter. And now I'm mad that we have to wait until May for the rest of it. So
yeah.
That's usually a good sign, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just looked it up. Tower of Nero published in October 2020, so it's been a little over 2 years since then, which is not that long of time in the publishing world, because usually you get a book per year, so really we only just skipped a year, but, like, it still feels like a long time.
It feels like a long
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and, like, because we're going to be so much closer to Nico in this book, it's feels like a long time since we've gotten, like, a significant amount from him. So, yeah, I'm also very, very excited about that.
Yeah.
But, so your overall thoughts, positive, obviously. You know, I feel like we kind of asked all of our questions, all of our theories, but is there anything else that kind of jumped out to you? I just keep thinking about that, like, have to make a decision thing that yeah. is just looming over my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe it's a little interesting to me that considering the description for the book and that we all kind of know that Bob is involved and Bob is the voice, I'm a little intrigued as to Nico not having any guess who the voice is. Like, he doesn't seem to have acknowledged, like, oh, I know who that is in this chapter. I just thought, here, he talks about it being the voice. The voice from Tartarus.
Like, he almost doesn't want to name who he knows it is.
Yeah, and so I just thought it was interesting that, like, he doesn't give it a name. He doesn't say, like, I think, you know, I'm nervous, I'm feeling guilty about feeling happy while I'm pretty sure that was Bob in Tartarus or whatever. Like, he doesn't give a name to it, he just calls it the voice. And so I just thought that was an interesting, like, note. Because it's like he really, like, it's almost like he's trying to not feel responsible, but at the same time he's like, no, that's my problem.
Yeah, because I think he has this, like, intrusive thought where it's like the voice is saying, like, oh, have you forgotten me like everybody else has? And you're right, he doesn't name Bob, and I feel like it's this place of, yeah, like, trying to set it aside and allow himself to be happy, but, like, just being unable to do that until this is taken care of.
Yeah. Just one of those things that kind of, you know, sat in my head as I'm reading it. Like, really? Like, okay, all right.
So, who knows if we will be getting a chapter 2 before the book comes out. It's very likely, usually, they do drop at least the first 3 chapters, I would say. Usually, they release them to different websites and stuff like that. So, if they do release another one, we'll probably do this again, just because it's fun to be able to talk about it in detail.
Now, the real question, and I'm throwing this at Karen without any prep, will we redo chapter 1 when we get the book, or will we just skip it
and go?
Like, are we going to do a chapter by chapter?
So, yeah, so I've actually been thinking about this as well, because I think what we'll do is when the book is initially dropped, we will probably do what we do with the other books in that we will just kind of review it. We'll do one episode about the whole book. We'll talk about it. We'll have a spoiler section where we can freak out about everything that happened.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at some point I would like to do a chapter by chapter. Although, technically, this book does take place after Trials of Apollo, so are we going to wait however many years until we get to it?
We'll see.
Maybe it'll depend on how much we love this book, and if it's like...
And, I mean, we are planning on getting into the Egyptian books, so it would kind of be a while before we could get... Even if we did the Egyptian books and then said, okay, we're going to do Son of the Star, it would still be a while, so we'll have to...
We would get to Chalice of the Gods before we got to the Son of the Star, because... chronologically, that comes beforehand.
Yeah.
So, I know. There's so much to do.
We'll see.
We'll definitely be talking about it when it comes out on May 2nd. We might even do more than one episode about it, depending on how much we have to say. We could do an entire spoiler episode instead of a spoiler section.
We've done that before.
Yeah, if you guys have any preferences, let us know. This is obviously a big deal and a big book in the Percy Jackson canon, so we want to give it its due, but... probably in terms of if we want to stick to the chronology, we'll wait for a long time. If we don't, we can do it whenever, honestly.
We run this podcast, and we can do whatever we want. We can break the rules, rules that we have set forth. Right. Yeah, we'll see what happens, but either way, we will definitely be discussing this book in May, so.
Yeah. But yeah, let us know what you guys think about that, and now it's time to get into yet another chapter of The Last Olympian. We're getting close.
We are. We're getting these last little bits of story that you have to wrap up, some things that need to be wrapped up, and then also some new kind of intriguing elements.
Some developments.
Too. Yeah, there's a few developments. Okay, so chapter 21 is entitled Blackjack Gets Jacked. Annabeth and Percy are making their way toward the elevator when Percy sees Hermes staring at an iris message in a side courtyard. Hermes is marveling at the mortal news coverage, trying to explain away all the damage and destruction that Kronos, Typhon, and the gods and demigods did during battle. Not to mention all those statues that are sitting in pieces all over New York City. Hermes is amazed at the resiliency of humanity, as well as their willingness to believe whatever the mist manipulates them to see. He and Percy have a seriously touching heart-to-heart about Luke, including Percy apologizing to Hermes for assuming he was a terrible father, rather than the one that just knew how things had to play out and couldn't intercede. Hermes sort of apologizes for being so hard on Annabeth, admitting that he hoped she may have been able to save Luke from his fate when Hermes couldn't do anything to stop it. Hermes then reminds Percy that Kronos cannot be properly killed, and hopefully he's scattered in so many pieces that he'll never reform, but he is out there and cannot be literally killed. Percy then tells Hermes that Luke loved him in the end, and eventually Hermes and Percy separate, and Percy makes his way back toward the elevator, toward Annabeth, only to come upon Athena. She questions his decision to remain mortal and basically warns him that she's keeping an eye on him, and she leaves some scorch marks on his shirt to remember her by. Percy and Annabeth then descend to the ground floor and find Paul and Sally in the lobby. Everyone is glad to see everyone in the flesh and know that they're for sure okay and made it through battle. And then pretty soon after that, Nico runs into the lobby and tells Percy that Rachel Elizabeth Dare stole Blackjack and is on her way to camp after. Dun, dun, dun! Okay, so yeah. The biggest part of this chapter is Percy and Hermes and this conversation, this heart-to-heart about Luke and everything that went down and all the things that Hermes couldn't say and all of that. And I think I like that it starts with Hermes just kind of marveling at the mist and the mortals and saying, like, you know, they really are willing to believe anything other than see what actually happened here.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's for their own safety. It's to keep them in the dark so that they don't get involved in all this other stuff. So yeah. We get this time and time again. Like, other gods mention, like, well, those humans, you know, the mist takes care of that. I don't have to worry about it. And so I love getting a moment with Hermes where he just kind of, like, is almost in awe of their ability.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like this, too. And it always brings me back to Buffy. Like, the way that, like, human beings will just write off the supernatural because our brains cannot comprehend that it's possibly real. And at least in Percy Jackson, you have something else aiding in that. You have the mist. And yeah, I've always really liked how the mist operates. So this was really cool. And even for Hermes to be impressed by it, I feel like is pretty telling.
Like, it makes me curious, like, how the mist came to be. Is it, like, a godly invention? Is it something that a god along the way created so that they wouldn't have to constantly be trying to mollify mortals? Like, how did the mist come to be?
I would imagine it's, like, a primordial kind of thing, but there's no, like, as far as I know, god of the mist kind of thing. How, like, darkness and chaos are, like, personifications of those concepts. I don't think there's a personification of the mist, although that would be very interesting.
Right? Or, like, I'm thinking of, like, different gods that could have had a hand in creating the mist, because you'd need, you know, like, a god that has some sort of specific magic or the ability, I'm thinking Hecate.
Right.
Who's, like, involved in the actual magic of it, and then you've got gods that were, you know, are, like, gods of forgetting and memory and dreams. True. And, like, you could involve a couple of different gods in the creation of this.
Yeah. Poseidon for the water.
For the actual mist element of it. Yeah. So there's definitely, That's a thread that if Rick ever wanted to play with, even for a short story or something, like, just a little bit of history of the mist and how the mist came to be, that's something I would be interested in reading.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
But yeah, okay, we'll keep right on along, moving along here. Hermes states that he will be helping the mortals, and his role is reassuring them that the things that they're seeing are not the things that they saw.
Because, of course, that's his job.
Right.
Because he has every job.
Exactly. as the messenger god, it's his job to go between and help smooth the edges and all of that. So I feel bad that he has to do it because he's still mourning the loss of his...
Yeah.
The actual loss of his son. He's been in mourning since Luke was born because he's known the entire time what was going to happen. But, like, now he's actually getting a chance to feel it because everything is played out. So... I liked Percy's apology to Hermes probably the most out of anything else in this chapter, because he not only says, like, hey, I was wrong, but he goes on to be like, I understand now that it wasn't that you just didn't want to deal with Luke. You wanted to stop it. You wanted to intercede. You wanted to help, but you literally could not, because you knew not only was he going to die, but that he was going to, in the end, be the one to save us all and make that sacrificial move. And anything that Hermes would have done, even a hint or anything, could have ruined that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, how hard that must have been as a parent,
yeah,
to have to stay completely... What's the word? Uninvolved in that
right.
entire scenario.
Yeah.
Like that.
It's the idea of save the person that I love or save the entire world. That is such an impossible decision, because you can save that person, but then what kind of world would you be living in together? And also, is one person's life worth thousands, millions, billions of other people? So, like, yeah, I mean, for Hermes, who as a god is kind of all-knowing, you know, this was just a huge thing for him. And I have to say that, like, as much as Hermes's attitude has bothered me in the past, and how that I don't think we're really meant to like any of the gods. They all have very complex characteristics and facets to their personalities. But in this moment alone, I actually also really appreciated Hermes, because he had to let Luke find his own path. And this is such a mature parent thing to do. Like, not a lot of parents can do that. A lot of parents like to micromanage their kids and make sure they're on the right path at all times. And as somebody who would rather make a mistake and learn from that mistake so that I know what's going to happen, so that I can kind of do it on my own, versus somebody else who just tells me how to do something where I don't get that learning experience, like, I really appreciate this. And I think that if, you know, maybe not in this exact scenario, but if more parents were like Hermes, the world could potentially be a better place. But hopefully we're not running into issues of, you know, children destroying the world and parents letting them get to this point. Because Luke got pretty far.
He did.
Before that actual sacrifice happened.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. Okay, so after Percy's apology, Hermes kind of feels compelled to apologize to Percy, too. More so, he owes Annabeth an apology, but he kind of delivers this apology to Annabeth through Percy.
Yeah.
He apologizes because he saw Annabeth and Luke in that moment, and her having an opportunity to maybe change his fate. If she had gone with him, she might have been the force that could have steered him away from Kronos or something, you know. Like, it wasn't on Annabeth to fix it, but Hermes could not help but feel this last, you know, vestige of hope that Annabeth would have that impact, and ultimately, even she couldn't stop what was going to happen. And him being mad at Annabeth was all just him being mad that he was incapable and not allowed to do anything. And so it was nice that he at least... I mean, he's a god. They don't apologize, like, ever. So it was nice that he felt compelled to kind of at least give Percy this much and say, yeah, I was wrong.
Yeah, it's funny. Now that you pointed out, like, the fact that he's saying this to Percy instead of Annabeth is quite funny.
Yeah, like, he should be apologizing to Annabeth, but that would require talking to two demigods, and he's not doing that. We also get a reminder that Kronos isn't dead, hopefully will never reform, or that it will take a very, 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 very long time. But it's worth noting that, like, he is a Titan and is not capable of being destroyed, so yeah, that's a thing. The other Titans are in hiding. We get specific notes that, like, Prometheus has excuses and is, like, trying, you know, he's...
I really liked that part.
Right, me too. He's kind of just... staying away, sending notes to the gods, letting them know that, like, hey, I was only on Kronos' side because of this. So I thought that was a nice note to add, like, no, the other Titans didn't just get away with it. Like, they are hiding for their own, trying to save their own skin. Percy also softens the loss for Hermes by sharing this message that he believes that Luke loved his father in the end. Luke was furious with Hermes for 99% of his life. But Percy kind of shows Hermes that in the end, Luke saw that this moment is why his father couldn't be there. Like, he didn't have a lot of time in the end to kind of piece everything together. But, like, I like that Percy takes this moment to be like, Hermes, he knew. He knew that you loved him. He loved you back. He knew that this was ultimately what had to happen. And, you know, it's all touching and makes me want to cry.
I feel like this was a little bit of bullcrap on Percy's point. I mean, I think that he wanted to feel this way. And maybe this is just, like, the cynical part of me coming out. But, like, I find it very hard that, like, in his dying moments, Luke was like, oh, yeah, I do love my father, you know? Because it's very hard after everything that he'd been through. Like, maybe he understood why Hermes stayed out of it. Maybe he understood what was going on in the end. But, like, that's a lot of baggage to get over.
It's true.
In your dying breath. So I feel like part of this was Percy probably hoping that this was the case, and also him just trying to comfort Hermes, which I will not blame him for. I mean, it's probably the smartest thing for him to do, but I was like, yeah, I don't know about that.
I don't necessarily think that it's something that Percy, you're right. I don't think it's something that Percy knew happened. Like, it's not like Luke looked at him and said, I love my father.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Make sure you tell him.
He's British, by the way. I don't know why I said father the way I said father just now. But, like, I do think that in that, Percy's interpreting everything that happened in that moment.
Yeah.
And is saying, like, dude, he loved you. He knew, you know, like, in the end, he knew that this wasn't something you could stop. Like, I think that's more or less what he's trying to get across.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you're right. If anything, he's just trying to help Hermes come to terms, and that's nice, too. They kind of have a quick discussion of this oath that Percy has made all of the gods take, and Hermes says, like, you know, we can try, and we're gonna, you know, live up to this oath for a little while, but, you know, eventually it's all gonna go back to the way it was because we can't help ourselves, we can't change. And Percy's like, I believe you can change. And Hermes basically promises to give Percy a list of all of his children so that Percy can make sure they get to camp and are trained. And, like, I think it's crap that the gods are like, no, we just can't change, it's whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you're gods. You can literally do anything. You can make an adjustment in yourselves.
Yeah. I think that, you know, nobody's held them responsible before.
Yeah.
So they've had eons of existing this way. I can understand how it's difficult for them, but it's like, if you wanted to, you would.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue, I think. I think Hermes is willing to do it. I think he's scared, you know, that he's gonna mess up, but I think he's willing to do it. Poseidon, Athena, I think they're very willing to do it. Zeus feels like he's probably not willing to do it, but because he agreed to it, he has to.
Yeah.
But this was very interesting to me, this conversation, because Hermes thinks that they'll forget, that they can't change their nature. The changing of their nature is a theme in the Heroes of Olympus books, because we see the Roman side of their personality.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that kind of funny that he's like, we can't change, except in the next book they're totally going to change. But also, like, just that dichotomy of those two sides and then trying to be better parents and everything. I'm very curious going forward into Heroes of Olympus when we get to those books, seeing how they are being better parents and how the Roman side of that is going to come into play as well. But this is what I was talking about in terms of Rick's legacy before, because this scene really struck me as how it almost feels like a story out of Avatar The Last Airbender. Because in Avatar, like, we've had Aang's story, and then we have Korra's story afterwards, and they're making another one as well. And there are so many iterations of the Avatar. Books have been written about, like, Kyoshi, who came before Aang, and other characters in this universe, other versions of the Avatar, where it's like they all kind of exist inside the Avatar. They each have their own personalities. They're their own person, but you can kind of reflect back on everything that's been done before.
It's kind of like the Doctor, too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly.
It's very much like Doctor Who and the Doctor.
100%. And this reminded me, not that Rick needs any more stories, and I'm sure that this has already occurred to him, but, like, that the next generation after Percy, there will be another Percy Jackson, you know? There will be somebody else who might have to take up this role of reminding the gods of their promise, of, you know, the fact that they need to be better parents. And the gods are always the constant in this story. They are the same characters, more or less, throughout these generations. But they still have new lessons to learn, and the demigods will be there to support that. And I was like, wow, like, that's really interesting to me that this kind of is endless in a way, that, like, this story is never over because the gods are always going to exist, and there's always going to be this battle of power between them and the Titans, them and the demigods, between each other. I just got very excited, like, thinking about all of this.
Yeah, I mean, heck yeah. And this could be a potential future if, you know, like, let's say Rick has written all of the books for all of the characters, all the, you know, he's done a Nico story for Piper and for all the people you want. And, you know, he's like, I don't want to write another Percy Jackson series, but I like the Greek gods, I like the Olympian gods, and I want to stay in this universe. He could jump forward 100 years, 200 years, you know, like, he could jump forward or even back and tell a new story about a new kid. And whether or not he wants to complete, you know, involve characters from the Percy world, he could completely leave them behind and start fresh, but still be with these Olympian gods and still be learning new lessons and things. Absolutely. You're 100% right. Like, he could keep this going forever. It wouldn't have to be Percy involved forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
It's just cool.
I would love stories set in the past, like in the 70s, you know, in the 40s. I feel like, especially the 40s with, like, the pact and everything, that would just be fascinating to me.
Yeah.
You could write a Nico story then, too. It would actually still work.
You could write a young Nico.
Yeah.
Aww. Young Nico. Anyway. I'm just thinking of mythos.
Oh, Mythomagic?
Mythomagic Nico and, like, all the figurines.
I know. He was so happy.
I know.
It hurts so much.
It's okay. It's gonna be fine.
Yes.
Okay. So, that's the end of their conversation. They've hit, you know, all the high points. And so, Percy starts to make his way to the elevator, and he runs into Athena.
Yep.
And this, I just have to say, like, the way he describes her standing in the road, like, she's back in, like, mortal size, but she just has this energy that pulsates out of her that you can't avoid, and so it's like he knows he's in trouble the minute he sees her, but walks up anyway, and she basically wants to know his reasons for staying mortal, and you know she knows what the real reason, like, of the biggest reasons.
It was a very leading question.
Yeah, like, she absolutely knows, and he starts with other things. He starts with, I want to grow up. I want to be a normal kid. I want to have a normal high school experience. And I want to do the things. I don't want to skip ahead and be immortal and not live and grow and be, you know, be a whole person. And then he says, as well as I couldn't leave her. And Grover, too. Like, he skips forward because he knows that Athena is well aware of their connection, and she doesn't like it because she's Athena. And, yeah, it just cracks me up because in rom-coms and, you know, YA romance stories, there's always that parent who's a giant pain in the butt.
Usually a dad, too.
It's usually a dad.
Yeah.
Who's a giant pain in the butt when it comes to the two protagonists trying to, like, make their love story work. There's always a parent who gets in the way and is a giant pain. I just love that it's Athena. Like,
yeah.
You know, because Poseidon doesn't really seem to be involved. He does not have strong opinions, I don't think, about Annabeth.
Yeah.
He doesn't ever really express a dislike of her or anything like that. Maybe he feels it and just doesn't really say anything because Percy is Percy and has proven he's going to make his own decisions. But, like, I love that Athena is like, yeah, I don't like this, but yeah, whatever. She also acknowledges her previous warning where she believed that in order to save a friend, Percy would destroy the world. And that did not, in fact, come to fruition. He was able to save the world and also keep Annabeth and Grover safe, as well as many of his other friends.
Yeah.
There are people who died and, you know, yeah, we'll get there eventually someday. But
I love when a god can admit they're wrong. And especially Athena, because she's rarely wrong, and I'm sure that plays into her ego a lot. So the fact that she was able to do this, to say this to him of all people,
mm-hmm,
I feel like is very significant.
And she basically, I mean, she's not giving him any sort of blessing, but she's, yeah, saying, like, I'm keeping an eye on you. You weren't wrong. You made the right decision in there. But it doesn't mean I like it.
Yeah, exactly. I really like her.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Gotta love Athena. And I love that she also leaves him with singes in his shirt.
Yeah.
Like, she can't just, like, poof or get out of there. No, she goes in, like, a blaze of glory so that he has singe marks going up his shirt for Annabeth to ask about.
One final warning.
Right? Just a little, this is how close I can get.
Yeah, this is your reminder of who I am.
Right? Gotta love it. Okay, so, yeah, he gets to the elevator. Him and Annabeth descend. They go to the lobby where Sally and Paul are fighting the guard.
Yes.
Which I just love. They know he's okay.
Mm-hmm.
They've seen the sign. We'll get there.
Yeah.
They've seen the sign, but that's still just not enough. They want to see him. And it's funny to me that they're fighting the guard to go up, but Sally knows she can't go up.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what was she trying to do?
She even admonishes Paul for, like, wanting to go up, like, two paragraphs later.
So was she going to the observation deck to wait? Like, TikTok, Percy. Like,
I don't know.
Like, I don't know what she was, or maybe she just wanted to be at the foot of the elevator so that the minute he showed up, she'd see him. I don't know. But I thought it was funny that
I don't think she was thinking clearly.
She's fighting the guard, and then a minute later, she's like, you can't go up there, Paul.
Yeah.
Like, it's funny. It's just hilarious. But they're all happy to see, you know, Sally and Paul are happy to see Annabeth and Percy alive and well, but Percy and Annabeth are happy to see that Paul and Sally made it as well.
Yeah.
And I love the moment between Annabeth and Paul where she's like, that was some seriously good sword fighting. And Paul's like, yeah. Like, you can see him, like, it's hard not to picture him as, like, a Paul Rudd almost.
Yeah.
And you can just see him being like, thanks.
I feel like Paul Rudd would be so good.
He would be fantastic. I love it so much. I have to say that in my copy, the stupid flag is back.
Yeah.
It's not, like, a huge deal. Apparently, you know, again, we don't care. We know what the original story had. But in my book, at this moment, Sally says, I'm telling you, my mom yelled, we have to go up, my son. And then she sees Percy, and she says, we saw the blue flag, but then you didn't come down. You went up hours ago. And I'm just like, it's a stupid flag.
Yeah, and mine literally says blue light. Like, I think that's the only difference in the entire thing. I guess this is a good time to talk about the fact that I did tweet this out because we were very curious. We were wondering, like, okay, is it older versus newer books? Like, why did they change that? There must have been a reason. Spoiler alert, there's no reason.
we don't know.
Yeah, because Becky responded to us. She saw our tweet, and she responded. Because we had a couple of people write in. The first one, I think, was KRose1399, Four Eyes for Life, which if you're a glasses wearer, I appreciate that. I assume that's what that means. But they wrote in basically the fact that they have May 2022, the new covers, the physical copies, has the blue light, no flags or anything like that. We basically figured out that it's like the e-copy.
Yeah, all print books have the light.
Right, exactly. So Becky says, I don't have an answer for this, but perhaps the wrong file was submitted for the digital version on Kindle because you have the Kindle Unlimited version.
Correct.
This is an easy mistake to make. I'm fairly certain there are not substantial differences. Can one even see flags flown from the observation deck at ground level? I was like, fair point. You know, we were kind of thinking, because it's a 50-foot flag, that it would be easier to see than, like, a blue light during the daytime.
Yeah.
And Becky responded, "We wouldn't consider this a typo, which happens in publishing despite best practices, but this kind of difference in the text I think is fun. Reminds us that non-US and Canada readers experience books that have been translated, including in the UK, so many other differences exist as well." And that's true. When you get a translated copy, things don't translate exactly, so what they might envision in their head could be slightly different than how it's meant in the source material, like, you know, Rick's version that he wrote.
Well, and this kind of makes sense. People who live outside the U.S. may not know that the Empire State Building lights up literally. In a translation of this book, they may have changed flag and light around because of the connotation in other languages, and they just figured using a blue signal, literally a blue flag, is easier. And then when it got in the translation back to English, somehow the flag never got changed back to a light, and that's how we ended up with this. It's a fascinating kind of journey through paperbacks to ebooks to, you know, little things like this can change in a story as they're making all those changes. And it doesn't change anything in the story. It doesn't, you know, alter anything drastic or anything, but it's just a little thing that we found that was different.
Yeah, super interesting. And you would think that for us as US readers, the Kindle version that you get would be the same ebook version, but there must have just been something early on in the ebook version that got switched to that and then it was never changed. But doesn't change the content, really.
Yeah, or if somehow when they were changing it over to Kindle Unlimited, a weird version got uploaded or something. I don't know. But I'm glad that Becky is aware of it, because if Rick doesn't like that this is a thing that exists, he knows about it now. Because who's going to tell Rick, "Oh, by the way, I noticed there's a flag instead of a light in your book"? When I read it, I didn't necessarily remember the light. Like, it felt a little weird. I was like, was it really a flag? But I didn't make note of it or anything. So, you know, if all we did was make sure Rick is aware that there's a flag in his book.
Yeah.
In the e-version, then so be it.
Yeah.
But it is fun just to kind of discover these little random things.
Yeah. And to get an answer from Becky about why this could possibly be, and the fact that it's not really that big of a deal.
Right. It was very cool. Very cool. Yeah, so we kind of already talked about it, but Paul does ask Percy if the 600th floor thing is true. And Percy says, "Yeah, that's Olympus. It's right up there." And he's like, "I want to see it." If Sally tells him, like, "You can't, like, you'll die. It's not for mortals. Like, you can't go up there." But, I mean, if I were Paul, I'd be saying the same thing.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, I'm going to go there.
Like, come on. So that was good fun. At that moment, though, Nico runs in and has bad news. Poor Nico, deliverer of bad news. Yeah, Rachel Elizabeth Dare was seen on 32nd Street, and Nico was talking to her, and she stole blackjack and said, I have to get to Camp Half-Blood, and she is on her way to Half-Blood Hill.
Yeah.
We know that she's mortal, and that could mean death.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. This was not the standout part of this part to me, because the chapter is called Blackjack Gets Jacked, and I 100% thought that meant, because I didn't remember, that, like, Zeus made Blackjack extra buff. Like, that was his gift for helping in the battle. And, like, when it was like, "Oh, yeah, she stole Blackjack," I was like, "Oh, that's what that chapter title meant." I was fully expecting,
like, at the end,
to come in.
For him to come in all buff.
Yeah.
Like, "Look what I got from Zeus." Yeah. That's hilarious.
I know. And it took me by surprise. But that aside, you know, obviously we already kind of know what's going on here, but finally some Rachel answers.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for the next chapter.
The last we saw, she was running out of the Empire State Building, so I don't know what she was looking for when she ran out. Like,
yeah.
She obviously was getting away from battle, but, like, you know, was she looking for Blackjack? Was she trying to figure out a way to get to Camp Half-Blood? Or, you know, I'm curious what was going on.
Yeah.
But we'll get more of Rachel Elizabeth there in the next chapter.
Yep.
So we will find out more about what she's up to. We already know. Okay, we should do favorite quotes and favorite moments. Mine was the interaction with Athena. Conversation? I don't know. And Percy says, "I want to be a regular guy. I want to grow up. Have, you know, a regular high school experience." And Athena says, "And my daughter?" And Percy says, I couldn't leave her or Grover or... And Athena says, spare me.
Yeah. She knows what's up.
It's the sass. In this moment, Percy was not the character I wanted to quote. Yeah. It was Athena because it's the spare me.
It's that moment where, like, you come home and your parent, like, catches you sneaking out of the house or, like, past curfew. And, like... They have you. Like, you're caught, and they're just waiting to see if you're going to admit it or come up with some excuse. And Percy went the excuse route, and she was just done with it.
Like, yeah, you want all that stuff. But we know one of the major reasons why you did this. Yeah. Say it out loud. Tell me now. Yeah, no. I just love Athena. What was yours?
Mine was from Percy when he says, I should have made that part of my gift from the gods. Better elevator tunes.
I think they said it was, like, Neil Diamond.
Yeah.
Which is, that's rough, guys. Come on. Come on. Pick better tunes. All right. And then our favorite moments. Mine was Paul Blofus wanting to see Olympus. He's just so wholesome. And, of course, you would want to see it. And I love that he's finding all of this out and he's not freaking out. Instead, he's like, I want to see it.
He's
I want to go.
He's embracing it. Yeah.
It's just cute. And I love him so much. What was yours?
Mine plays off of your favorite lines because it's when Athena scorches the front of Percy's shirt. It was just so funny and so unnecessary, but, like, she had to do it.
Right. She just had to. We are getting closer and closer to the end of this book. So next week we will be reading chapter 22. So make sure you do that. And that you'll be all ready for our discussion next time. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions about Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy and Angel, and many more. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has discussed every episode of the show, contains exclusive interviews, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie, as well as Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that would be so great. You can leave us questions or comments, ideas for episodes, or things you want to hear us talk about in any of these places, and we will do our very best to get back to you in a timely manner. We did have some feedback this week, but we kind of already addressed it. We wanted to make sure to thank Becky for getting in touch about the blue light / flag situation, and that was a lot of fun, so we appreciate that. Next week, we are taking a... listener suggestion. Yeah, you're all reading this. We're taking a listener suggestion, and we're going to talk about the constellations and their role in Greek myths and where they come from, all of that stuff. So it's going to be a fun episode. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this, too. Quiva was the one who suggested this after we had talked about a couple of constellations in some of the myth, like, deep dives that we did. And I haven't been able to stop thinking about this because I love astrology and astronomy and all that kind of stuff, and I'm very curious. I don't know how I'm going to do it yet. I might just pick a handful to talk about, and then we can always come back later for a second part, but we're definitely going to be talking constellations and Greek mythology next week.
Can I also just say, I went and saw a movie with my boyfriend yesterday, and before the movie, you know how they do all that stupid little trivia stuff?
Yeah.
One of the hosts' name was Quiva. Spelled the same way hers is.
Cool.
And I was like, oh my god, I know how to say that.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, this is so cool. So, like, I just want you to know, thank you, because it made me feel, like, really, like, cool that I understood her name and how to spell it. I was like, that's so neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just one of those little things. I was like, hey, it reminded me of the podcast and made me think of our, you know, friend of the podcast, Quiva, who's constantly giving us great feedback.
Thank you.
Thank you again. All right. And until next week, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.